Our speaker is Derek Sherman, who's a professor at Calvin University, and he'll be talking to us on design norms and virtues for artificial intelligence education and design.
Well, thank you, Paul. So, as a professor in a computer science program, we teach machine learning. We teach coding, we teach algorithms. And the question then becomes, what kind of ethical framework should we use when we're teaching students who are going to go out there in industry and begin to create systems and software? How should they think about their work as computer scientists? And of course, there are all kinds of different frameworks that you can choose. I think I looked up some AI frameworks in particular, and there was well over 100 that have already been proposed all around the world. And of course, that's in addition to the professional frameworks like the ACM Code of Ethics and the IEEE Code of Ethics and so on, which are also available. And I think they all have overlapping sort of aspects, and they all have good things to say. But as a and of course, here you can see a bunch of other organizations, AI for Good, Ethics of Artificial Intelligence, recommended by UNESCO, the Montreal Declaration on Responsible AI, Partnership on AI, and Ethically Aligned Design from IEEE. But Calvin University is a Christian university. We're working explicitly out of a Reformed Christian framework. A lot of these values and frameworks are helpful, as I mentioned, but their underlying beliefs and values are not often made explicit. And so they require discernment by Christians who sort of embrace them. And so we asked ourselves the question quite some time ago, actually, is there a set of guidelines for AI that might be explicitly informed by Christian thinking that we might be able to use? And Calvin has a history of working within the Reformed tradition. And in particular, there is an academic known as Herman Dooyeweerd, who was a Reformed philosopher in the Netherlands in the mid-20th century, working out of the tradition of Abraham Kuyper and John Calvin and others, who actually worked to build a perspective of reality, which he claims is aspectual. So in this little diagram is kind of a summary of a lot of his writings, but this idea that integral reality, the experience we all have, for instance, right here in this room, is made up of many different aspects that are irreducible to each other. So there is number here, right? There's a certain number of people. We all, our mass adds up to a certain number and so on, but there's also other things going on. There's social connections between people. There's economic things going on. You paid to be here. There are faith aspects. There's all kinds of aspects of reality. And with the human mind, we can analyze reality and break out the different types of aspects that are there in order to understand created reality better. And he proposed roughly 15 modal aspects, he called them, in which are distinct ways in which reality exists. And here is a list of all of them. So from the lower sort of aspects, like the numeric, all the way up to the faith or pistic norms, as they're sometimes referred to. And so he says all of reality has, these sort of 15 things going on. And they're all distinct. You can't reduce the social interaction down to a biological functioning, although it relies on biology. And you can't reduce the aesthetics in the world down to a numeric representation, although there are numeric aspects to everything that's going on. But these are all sort of aspects that are simultaneously happening when we're working. And so his philosophy is, intrinsically anti-reductionistic. He says all of these things are not reducible to the others, and that most of human living, including our experience here, is multi-aspectual. And that these aspects can be divided into laws and norms. And so if you look at the lower end of his list here, numeric, spatial, kinematic, physical, biological, these are all governed by laws that we're sort of obliged, that impinge on us, that we have no choice to follow F equals MA or 1 plus 1 equals 2. That's just the reality of the world. The higher aspects here actually are normative, which means that they require us to respond with freedom and responsibility. And things like economics and social and justice-related aspects are things in which human beings have to respond and can choose to ignore those norms, or they can align with them. And that's where human responsibility comes in. And if you look at most engineering and computer science programs, they tend to sort of live in this world. In fact, it's highly numeric in many ways. And so, so when you're teaching engineers and computer scientists, you're looking at only one slice of reality. It's a kind of way of developing tunnel vision if you don't consider the other aspects of reality, especially the normative aspects. So, so these are the things that we also need to be attentive to as engineers and computer scientists when we're designing products, because these things are also happening when we're creating a product. So way back in the mid-1980s, the Kelvin Center for Christian Scholarship at Kelvin College then had a big grant that they put together in order to bring a bunch of folks together to write a book called Responsible Technology. And this has had a lot of impact, especially in the Christian engineering circles. So if you look at CCCU colleges and the Christian Engineering Society, this book had a huge influence. And what it did is it drew on this reformational philosophy from Herman Dooyeweerd, and it looked at these norms, and it actually created a list of normative principles for design. Basically, what it did is it took these higher aspects and it looked at how we might map them into considerations for engineering and design. And at Kelvin University, we've actually given these the phrase design norms. We refer to design norms. And all of our engineering and computer science students are exposed to these norms. So in our intro coding classes and in the introduction to engineering class, the students learn the design norms. The senior project course isn't just building some cool technology. Students are required as part of their design to do a normative analysis, applying all of the design norms to their design. And now that AI has become an increasingly important topic in computer science, we're looking at the normative ways of applying the design norms to artificial intelligence. So here's a little bit more specific summary of the design norms. So you'll notice that the words are a little bit different than what the aspects were named on the prior slides that I showed you. But these norms have been translated into words and phrases that will make more sense to engineers. And so the historical aspect is translated into cultural appropriateness, which is basically the norm of considering whether technology will relieve burdens while preserving what is good in a certain cultural context. And is the design appropriate to that particular context? So that's a normative consideration when you're creating a solution. There's lots of examples of how this goes wrong, in particular in doing service projects overseas with technology and so on. But also, you know, when computer programmers are supposed to do a design for a dentist's office, it should be appropriate for a dentist's office, and so dentists should be consulted as part of the process. Transparency is the norm of clarity, making sure that documentation is clear and unambiguous, that the layout color scheme of an interface is clear, to make sure that you don't bear false witness, that the product doesn't exaggerate its claims. The social norms have to do with whether the technology encourages community, hospitality, using the word that Ivan Illich used in his famous book, conviviality. Does the technology promote conviviality, teamwork, and cooperation? Social norms, I think, are also important when we're looking at the whole area of social networking. Stewardship norm, this is one that many engineering programs, also in secular settings, are focusing a lot on. We often refer to it as sustainability. But does the design consider the entire life cycle of the product? Is it repairable? Is it recyclable? Is it efficient? Does it use energy and other resources wisely? And this has implications for computing as well, of course. Delightful harmony is the norm that we've translated from the aesthetic norm, which has to do with beauty. That's also an important consideration that engineers are often not told to consider much in their programs. But, you know, can new users easily intuit the function of the design? So not only being beautiful, but the fusing of form and function. The philosopher Nicholas Wolterstorff said, a good Skarden spade is one that's not only good for digging, but is pleasing to use. So it's thinking about these things. In the computing side, there's a huge amount of emphasis on UX design, user experience, and human-computer interfaces. So that is that whole area. And not only is it sort of functional, but is it delightful? Is it beautiful? It's thinking of the aesthetic aspects. Justice, of course, is an essential norm. Many other frameworks for AI and for computing refer to justice. And so the questions there are basically, does this device promote fairness? Can it be easily used for unjust purposes? Thinking about the justice aspects. And then caring, you know, in what ways does this product help us show love for our neighbor? Who might be harmed if it's used? And then, of course, the trust norm has to do with whether or not we can rely on the device for the purposes for which it is designed. Is it safe and secure? I mean, this becomes even more important when we're building air traffic control systems or heart-lung machines, you know, making sure that things are dependable. But also it refers to where we place our ultimate trust, not putting our trust in AI or technology. And so these norms are a way of taking more into account. And so all of our programs at Calvin University use these norms as a framework for thinking about design decisions. So here are some examples of how these norms might apply to the area of artificial intelligence. So when we think about cultural appropriateness, we're thinking about AI, again, relieving burdens while preserving what's good in a context. Here you can see a couple of articles that are referring to the cultural aspects of a design in artificial intelligence, cultural bias and cultural alignment in large language models. A large language model for the West might not be an appropriate large language model for another cultural context. AI also has a sea of dudes problem. I don't know whether you've heard of this, but it's largely designed by men that women don't factor much into the consideration. They're not usually largely represented on teams in the design of this. And so people have been talking about some of those issues, which are cultural as well. When we think about the norm of transparency, AI ought to be clear and understandable. What is explainable AI? My colleague brought that up a little bit earlier. Lawmakers want you to know when you're talking to AI, when you pick up the phone and there's a voice that's talking to you, it should be transparent that you're actually dealing with a machine, if it actually is a machine and not a person. And then actually the working of algorithms that are used to determine, you know, who gets a job and who gets a loan and who gets a promotion should have some transparency to them. What are the things that are being considered? Or is it just a big black box? So that has to do with the norm of transparency. Social norms. One of the biggest use cases for large language models in the last year has been AI companionship. And so there's a lot of, I think, dysfunction there. I think a relationship between a person and an AI chatbot is a relationship of one person that actually diminishes your ability to have real, genuine human relationships, which are demanding and messy. An AI relationship is a relationship that's all about you. And so I think there's something anti-normative about that, or even creating machines that pretend to be people. That's another talk, though. And then how can AI help us to be more connected rather than less connected in an age of AI? That has to do with the social norm, building tools for conviviality. AI and the norm of stewardship. Maybe you've heard this, especially the training of AI systems and large language models requires a huge amount of electricity and power and water resources. And actually some of the places where these large data centers have been installed are places that actually have shortages and how it impacts the surrounding communities, which also kind of overlaps with a justice issue. But the norm of stewardship. In computer science in general, you know, we think about, you know, when we write an algorithm, how much time and space complexity does it take that translates to energy and other resources. And so the norm of stewardship is something that we ought to be thinking about. Green computing is a whole area that's sort of been built around this. The norm of delightful harmony, as I mentioned, that has to do with form and function, how AI can help with user experience enhancement, and how AI can actually more personalize our interactions with machines and with data systems in a normative way. AI in the norm of caring. If you read secular ethical frameworks, they often talk about the words beneficence and non-maleficence. But when we talk about caring in this normative way, we're thinking even bigger about how can we show love to our neighbor through the designs that we work on. Human-centered AI and AI to benefit people. And then the norm of AI and justice, I think, is a significant one. And you've probably heard references to this. A landmark book, which is a little dated now, is the book Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill, who was one of the pioneering data scientists. She actually had a bit of a conversion experience, not religious, but in terms of ethics, after the... after in 2007, when there was a large crash, and she was working in finance, and she was working on high-speed currency trading algorithms and other things that actually brought instability into the financial system that was in part responsible for the crash at the time. And then she actually began to expand her analysis, looking at how data and algorithms are determining who gets a job, who gets a promotion, who gets a loan, all these sorts of things, and began to see how the data that's used to train these systems can actually amplify injustice, because the data includes history of unjust decisions and bias against certain groups, and how that can be codified. And not only the data actually has a bias, the algorithms have a bias as well. But we don't have time to go into that. And then there's other well-known books like Automating Inequality. There's articles about how machine bias, how software that was actually used, it's the Compass system that was used in the U.S. to predict future criminals, was biased against African Americans in terms of deciding who gets parole. Amazon had a recruiting system that was biased against women. And so thinking about justice is a fundamental norm, especially for AI. And then the norm of trust. Can users depend on AI for its intended purpose? And what are actually applications where perhaps we ought not to use AI because we need to have a human responsibility inserted into the loop? But AI risks and AI trustworthiness now is an area of research. In Europe, they actually have more legislation now. I think in America, we're a little behind thinking about regulations also for AI, right? We have a Food and Drug Administration for drugs, and we have, FAA to sort of regulate airplanes. What should we do in the field of AI to make sure that to make sure that it's not applied in areas where we can't rely on it? And then the whole idea of making sure that AI is safe and that we can trust it is the norm of trust. So the whole field of trustworthy AI refers to AI systems that are explainable, fair, interpretable, robust, transparent, safe, and secure. So not just thinking about sort of anti-normative applications of AI, but I think, when we look at this normative framework, there are all kinds of applications where AI can actually be used to move us towards shalom. I'm kind of careful about the words I use. AI can't bring shalom, but it can be deployed towards shalom. And here are some examples, right? AI being used for earthquake predictions, AI for climate monitoring to increase crop yields, for drug discovery, for reducing car and traffic accidents, AI for precision medicine, AI for Bible translation. And we just had a presentation earlier about how AI can help with biblical languages. So all of these things have to do with areas where normative applications of AI, and there's lots of examples. In fact, one of the research projects I was involved in with a number of students almost a decade ago was looking at AI for the sorting of recyclable goods. So the local city I was in had a conveyor belt that was going at about a meter per second, and there was people literally hand sorting some of the things that couldn't be automatically detected, like polycode containers and other things. And we used a high-speed vision system and a field programmable gate array and a bunch of AI algorithms in order to automatically sort goods in order to increase the recycle rate on certain things. I think those are examples, right, that are tuned to the norm of stewardship and norm of care and so on. So there's lots of applications. But then the question becomes, you know, we have this these design norms that we present to our students, and they memorize them. They have to use them, as I mentioned, in different classes. They come up in the curriculum along the way, both in engineering and computer science. But it turns out that knowledge of ethics does not necessarily make us more ethical. So the, you know, it turns out that if you have a whole bunch of technical courses and you slap an ethics course on the end, you don't have an ethical computer scientist or engineer. Alistair MacIntyre, the famous philosopher of ethics, had this this famous chapter he wrote about the irrelevance of ethics, that, you know, looking at certain practices in certain fields where people's habits and rituals actually just negated any ethical training that they had. It formed them into certain kinds of people. You don't just simply add ethics to technology. So the question is, what ought we to do in, you know, at Calvin and other Christian universities if we're interested in this? And so I would say, you know, part of it is trying to help our engineers and our computer scientists cultivate virtues and character, right? So norms are actually describing the nature of created reality and the things we need to be attentive to. Virtues describe the kinds of people we are. And virtue helps us become the kinds of people who are then attentive to norms. Just memorizing norms isn't enough. And of course, virtues are shaped through practices, you know, shared telos and modeling. Right? As Christians, we have this sort of shared telos of having to love God and our neighbor as ourselves, right? Virtue modeling, hopefully our professors and our staff in our Christian colleges model virtue, wisdom, and humility. Practicing virtue, we actually have people at Calvin who've been looking at this for quite some time. How can we actually practice virtue in the classroom, you know, incentivizing service projects, encouraging practices of humility and courage. Lab groups being set up. Some of my colleagues have set up lab groups as accountability groups where you can actually, you know, not only just show up and do stuff together in the lab, but actually when your lab partner doesn't show up, you follow up, you find out what's happening with them, you care for them. Encourage students to sit next to people they don't know, to encourage hospitality. Encouraging virtue in the co-curriculum, sports, dorms, chapel. In one of my classes, I actually have my students do a digital fast to think about the role of technology in their life and practicing Sabbath and so on. So I think this is part of it, creating the kinds of people that will be attentive to norms. So here are some examples of some of some of those practices that hopefully shape our students. Overseas service projects we've done. We have local service projects. As faculty, we sometimes host students in our home. We have students involved in chapel. There can be a lot of close mentoring that happens in summer research projects with undergraduate students, practicing virtue on the sports field, dealing with problems that can arise in the dorm room and how do we practice virtue with annoying roommates, you know, service learning projects, all of these things that help shape a person. And I think a Christian liberal arts undergrad education is a many splendored thing. And we can think about all of these things working together. This is a quote from my colleague, Jamie Smith, who's done a lot of work thinking about habits and rituals and practices. And I like this quote, being a disciple of Jesus is not primarily a matter of getting the right ideas and doctrines into your head. Rather, it's a matter of being the right kind of person who loves rightly. So I think, you know, if we're thinking about ethics and we're thinking about ethical frameworks for AI and so on, we can have a framework and there are Christian frameworks that we can draw from. But it's also helping shape our students into the kinds of people who actually care about those sorts of things. That's the seal of Calvin. My heart I offer you, Lord, promptly and sincerely. Our hearts are part of this. So in summary, I think Dooyeweerd's philosophy is helpful. I'm not a card-carrying Dooyeweerdian, but his sort of framework of reality has been very helpful. And it's been used for a couple of decades now in engineering and computer science at Calvin. Design norms, I think, can also inform AI. And so thinking now about how can we apply these to the world of AI and also data science, by the way. Design norms can be referenced across the computer science curriculum. We talk about norms across the curriculum. And then teaching norms is how I concluded, right, is not sufficient. Just knowing all the norms and being able to list them off and rattle them off is not sufficient. Students need to cultivate virtues and character to become the kinds of persons who actually care about loving their neighbor and about being attentive to creational norms. So that's it. So thank you.
Okay. very much, Derek. We have a few minutes for questions.
So I envision that the adoption of these norms intersects with the personal spiritual commitments of the students. And is the perception that this goes differently depending on whether your poster child student is an actual believer in Jesus versus the average of all your other types of students?
Yeah. So the thing about norms is that they're creational. And so the thing is, you know, there is this saying by H.H. Farmer, if you go against the grain of creation, you get splinters. So even if people don't acknowledge a creator, I think you can kind of discern that there are certain ways that things ought to be in creation. And so a lot of these are intuitive. And I've even heard from students who've actually brought these up in industrial settings, right? It's hard to be... Actually, in the latest Christianity Today, July-August edition, it's about AI. There's an article about Christians working in the field of AI and industry. And there's an interview with a former student of mine who worked at OpenAI. And you can't, in a place like that, or at a large tech company, stand up and say, "Thus saith the Lord," and then kind of tell them how they ought to be. But you can talk about things like sustainability, and you can talk about, you know, aesthetics, and you can talk about caring, and you can talk, because all of these things are, I think, people recognize as things that we need to be attentive to, because if we don't, there's going to be consequences. And as Christians, we see this as the way it is, because that's the way God has tuned the world. But as non-Christians, I think there's an intuitive sense. I mean, C.S. Lewis talks about the Tao, right? That there is this idea of how things ought to be. And so students, even students who I think whose faith is something that they're maybe struggling with, or who might not identify with all of the Reformed and Christian principles behind this, see this as a helpful list. So
you would say most of this is in the realm of common grace.
I'd be careful using common grace, but yeah, because of common grace, people are attentive to this. Yeah. I actually once, this is an anecdote, I was at a conference, an ACM conference, and I met one of the people who helped write the ACM Code of Ethics. And I said, like, what values informed this? And he looked over his shoulder, and then he whispered to me, "Well, based on Judeo-Christian kind of, you know, thing." And he said, we wouldn't really write that in there. And I said, yeah, okay. And I think you can... Any other questions? These are being used at other Christian colleges too, actually. So the Responsible Technology book made its way through the Christian engineering circles, and people have found this as a helpful guide. And it does, if you take sort of other ethical frameworks, they overlap considerably. This goes a little further in some ways, like not only just not doing harm, but loving your neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah, thankful for your talk. Yeah, it's wonderful. So I'm just wondering whether you can share, you know, your resources with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Send me a note. And,
it's been a busy day.
Yes.
And we want to thank you again.
Yeah.